Welcome to the Going to Seed podcast. Today we are talking to Paul Ward, and I'll let him introduce himself because I've only just recently got to know him, but I'm already extremely fascinated by everything that he's working on. So Paul, can you tell us a bit about your background and the path that led you to crop breeding?
Well, I was born up in northern Victoria, in near a place called Swan Hill. It's a Mallee, in the Mallee country. It was traditionally a wheat and sheep dryland cropping area, and being along the Murray River, there was also irrigated, you know, stone fruits and vineyards and so forth. I wasn't really sort of so much interested in the farm as such, but I'd always had a thing for, you know, since I could go out and play in the dirt, I was always fascinated with nature and got interested in plants fairly early on in my life. I was interested in bush foods and things. Actually, when I was a little kid, my brothers and I used to play in the yard and back in the sort of late 60s, and my mother had planted a native garden. A garden consisted of mostly native plants around the yard, and had Dad draw up these little signs so that there were a little plate, and they'd stick in the ground with this little thing that we'd use as a handle. So it'd have the name on those labels, and we'd run around the yard with pulling these out, and we'd throw them around like tomahawks and things. But I had to know what the names of these trees were, so I knew where to put them back.
So you didn't get in trouble. In the 60s, that is really unusual for that time in history. Yeah. Like native gardens are common today, but back then.
Yeah. No, it was a little bit ahead of its time, I think. So they were mostly, you know, Western Australian native trees and things. So, before I was 10, I sort of knew the names of, you know, 30 or 40 plant species by their Latin name. So, I sort of had a fascination for it, and it led off into bush foods and carnivorous plants and orchids. And then I wasn't that great at school because I, you know, sort of ADHD and couldn't concentrate on that unless it was a subject that I really liked. And I'd get 98 and, you know, I'd blitz those subjects, but school just wasn't for me. Went off to work on the farm up at Balranald. We had a place up there, and that wasn't for me either. So I went and got a job in the forestry over in Mildura growing trees. And it was there that I sort of observed in a lot of older gardens where I developed by then an interest for edible plants and ethnobotany. So that was sort of the late 80s. And I noticed how in a lot of old gardens, plants would sort of fit together, you know, sort of as they would in a forest. And then it was soon after that that I discovered in a bookshop this book on permaculture. And I said, oh, damn, there's a name for this thing that I've been sort of chasing after. So went off and did a permaculture course in northern New South Wales with Bill Mollison and Jude Fanton from Seed Savers Network. And then a few months later, I found myself living up there and following the whole permaculture thing. And I was just interested in any plants that were used by humans on the planet. And that's been the tone for my life for quite a while. So yeah, that's where my interest in plants and in edible plants had come from. And in more recent years, I've got more into vegetable gardening. I was up in northern New South Wales for maybe 15 years or so. And
can I ask an odd question? So you've been around a bit longer than me, and you've probably seen like ebbs and flows in the general public interest in things like permaculture and growing your own food and crop breeding. Do you think that we're on the beginning of a new upslope in interest, that there's like that there's going to be a bit of a boom in people getting involved in, well, crop breeding is the focus of this podcast. So that's why I think that's one of the reasons I'm motivated to do this at this time in history. It feels like the ground is fertile to get more people breeding crops.
Yeah, I think so. With the sort of growth and popularity of farmers markets and you know, more knowledge of or awareness of the importance of localization of food. And then since COVID, with the sort of awareness people have of the fragility of the industrial food system, I think people are saying, oh, okay, we can't depend on this as much as we'd have thought. You know, well, we just didn't think about it, you know. A lot of people just didn't think about it before. You know, the shelves were empty after a few days, you know, of the trucks stopping, you know. So I think there's a little bit more of an awareness, and there's a lot, certainly a lot of people growing, you know, putting in raised veggie beds and all that sort of thing. Even people, you know, people in urban areas that you wouldn't, and people that you wouldn't normally think would care much about that, are actually having a go at it. So yeah, I think there's a lot more scope for improvement in knowledge of growing plants and then where those seeds have come from, you know, that, and that's where I think that, like the Central Victorian Landrace Breeding Project that Greg Muller started here in Castlemaine. He's over in Strathfield, so near Bendigo, you know, half hour's drive from here. He started that about 2 years ago and put out, you know, amassed a group of varieties of a particular crop and said, right, we're going to do this one this year or this season. For example, the first one was broad beans. He got about 20 different varieties from accessions from all around the world, accessed them from a seed bank, put them all together, mixed it all up, put it out to the community. They all took those seeds, grew them, and then to bring them back, and then we'll mix them all up again. And then you take another lot out, and you do that 3 years, and you know, you've got a really diverse population. So there's a few more people getting a bit of an understanding of the importance of like a broad genetic base for any given seed, so that you don't run into problems and you know, with disease or lower yields or inbreeding or whatever. So I think there's a little bit more knowledge about that now. So yeah, I think it is, you know, the time's right to push it a little bit more. Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, it's just that's the instinct I've got, but I always try and get other people's sense of the way the wind is blowing. So moving on, what are the conditions that you're growing under? Like what kind of space, soil temperatures, water fertility, weeds, pests, like all the things that you're dealing with and the resource base, the space that you have to grow your crops?
Okay, well, my wife and I and our two kids, we bought this place in 2018, I think it was. It's just south of Castlemaine, and it's unusual in that we're on a really quite a rich soil. We're in a little valley, and there's a lava flow above us on a plateau, and that's a basalt lava flow. I've got a friend who's geologist, and he says that it's about 40 million years old. So it's relatively young in Australian terms, contrasted with the rest of the area around Castlemaine, which is about 460 million years old. So that's going back before the dinosaurs when that soil was formed. So it's quite weathered, whereas ours is quite young and it's quite reactive. It's what's known as a Krasnozem soil. You'll have probably come across that sort of soil anywhere along the east coast. There'll be patches of it, you know, say up around Dorigo, up around Rosebank in the Northern Rivers area, Mount Tambourine, and then up, I think, on the Sunshine Coast, there's patches of that too. And it's one of my favourite types of soil to grow stuff in, because it you put a bit of organic matter in there and maybe a bit of calcium, and things really, really thrive in it. So, yeah, that's the sort of soil we've got. We have temperatures that get down to, you know, sometimes minus 6 or 7, maybe -8 overnight, which is really cold because we're right in this little valley, and the cold air just drops down off the plateau and it flows across the ground. So even under my veranda, we can get, you know, freestanding water in, say, in a dog's bowl or something. It'll freeze even underneath the veranda because the cold air comes in sweeps in sideways as it flows down the hill and it sucks the heat out of things. So I've been wanting to plant some hedges to just to sort of redirect that cold airflow across and to create little slightly warmer spots. But you know, when it gets down to -4 or -5, it's getting pretty cold. In the summers, we have, you know, your typical Mediterranean summers, nice and warm, but it can get cool at night. So we don't have that sustained heat that you would in a classic Mediterranean climate. We have our rainfalls around about 700 mils, thereabouts. We do have some tanks that we collect the rainwater from the roof of the house, and we use that predominantly. But then if we need to, we've got town water though. So that's a benefit there, a bit of a bonus.
Do you irrigate very much?
Yeah, we do. I usually just hand water the garden in summer. I can put out drippers and then just turn those on every few days. I do like to space veggies out quite a bit, and therefore there's a longer time between the need to have to come back to water. Mm. And I tried to build the soil down. So I'll use a broad fork. I made up a broad fork with some car leaf springs and cut them and forged them out in the forge, and then welded them to a crossbar, like a tread bar. So it's about 50 centimeters wide, and there's 5 tines across that. So, you know, 12 and a half centimeters apart. And I can dig down to, you know, deeper than 30 centimeters deep. I'm going to make another one soon to get down to about 40 centimeters, I think. So I can open the soil up down low, and I use that as the way to get moisture and fertile, you know, organic matter and air into the soil to keep things going along, you know, growing fairly well, rather than try to build the soil up. I don't mulch with around my veggies. All of my perennial plants, I'll mulch around those, but the annuals, given that they're originally from, well, most veggies have evolved from ruderal species, you know, plants that thrive on disturbance. They're usually the first plants in succession of, you know, from a bare soil to a forest. They're usually the very first ones. They don't team up with many mycorrhizal fungi. They're more bacterially dominant plant. You know, they prefer bacterially dominant soils, ones that have been disturbed. So I don't mulch them. I'll use a hoe to weed, and that also loosens the surface, and that creates that mulch, a mulch layer. Mm. It breaks the capillarity of the moisture trying to come up during the night when it's replenishing the soil at the surface. With that loose dust mulch, the moisture can't capillary attract through to the surface and disappear that way.
It sounds like you're a fan of Steve Solomon's approach to gardening. Have you read any of his books?
I have. Yeah, I've got a few of his books, and what he says in that makes a lot of sense from an ecological point of view. From that, as I just said before, with the most of those plants being evolved from ruderal species, mm-hmm. or species that are very early in succession, we do have pests. And I do like to direct seed, and that I find that mulch, like what Steve found, if you have mulch, all critters can hide in there and come out and eat your seedlings. So
I've recently started, now I've got the biomass close at hand that I'm growing myself. I've started doing very similar to you, but just mulching the paths after the first weeding. Once the crops are well established, they're past that fragile stage. That seems to be one possible compromise. And you can use much rougher biomass then. It doesn't have to be all like nicely machine ground into relatively fine particles to have a hope of getting the seedlings through it.
Yeah. And on the paths makes good sense too, because if you've got some organic matter on the path, it sort of spreads the load a bit. Mm. And it, you know, you're less likely to compact so much.
Though it's got to be the right kind of organic matter if you want to be able to hoe through it. If you get the odd weed that gets a spot through. So if it's the wrong kind of organic matter, then hoeing becomes a real nightmare because it just tangles everything up and gets in the way. So devil's in the details, people.
For sure. well, it's you know, it's like old school veggies, and you know, putting things in rows and, you know, good wide spacings in the rows and between them, it buys you time. It gives you your weekends back. You know, you don't have to water them every day like you do if you overplant and plant things really close. They start competing with each other, and then there's, you know, you have to water them every day. You don't have your weekends free, you know, so you can. So sometimes I can go away. Look, when we first the first crop of tomatoes I put on this place was when we were having the house built. The earthworks had been done for the site cut, and we had topsoil that was laid down on top of the topsoil on top of good soil. So it was like, we're really spoiled for soil here.
It's a rarity in Australia.
I planted out, well, yeah, and particularly in Castlemaine, where most of the topsoil was either turned upside down and buried during the gold rush, or it was washed away in the winters, or it was blown away in the summers and eroded. And it's all upside down country here. So luckily we didn't have a site that was as disturbed as that. And that was on the old Ordovician sediment, you know, the 460 million year old soils. We've got a very young soil, so we're really fortunate. I mean, that was part of what clinched it for us. Proximity to town, it had town water, and it had good soil. So it was a win-win-win in all of those.
Before I forget, where did you get your hoe?
Which,
because you mentioned you use a hoe for your weeds. So where do you get a good hoe these days? Because if you just go to our mega hardware store, Bunnings, and buy a hoe, you're going to think that anyone who wants to use a hoe is crazy, because they're such terrible hoes that they sell in Bunnings.
Yeah.
In Bunnings.
Well, generally with garden tools, I'll either, there's a brand called Corona. You're probably aware of those. They're usually pretty good. The old Cyclone hose, if you get old ones at garage sales, you'll generally see them, and spading forks, if you get old ones, old antique ones that, you know, people sell for $5 or something, they're just getting rid of the, you know, grandpa's shed contents, and they sell these things off. Particularly if you can get one with a longer handle rather than the short D handle, the spade type handle. I like a fork with a long handle on it. I don't have to bend down so much. Sometimes, like, my favorite one, I've lost it somewhere. I don't know what I did with it, but I'd forged that out of a piece of trailer leaf spring, and forged the socket on it, and then put a piece of elm from just down the road in there as a handle, and that was my favorite hoe. I think it's known as a Peterson hoe.
Yeah, the intermediate weight hose seem to be quite difficult to find. The really sharp, like, professional ones that they still produce in, like, Holland, I think, in parts of Europe, that are great for doing little tiny weeds when they first come up. You can buy those online if you look around for specialist distributors, but the range for the medium weight hose is difficult, and the quality of the iron, the metal that they use in the common new ones that you see around, is just, it's not up to the job anymore. So
it's like Bill Mollison.
If you're interested in going down this path, sorry, you go.
It's like Bill Mollison used to say with a hoe or a fork. He said that's not a fork. It's something in the shape of a fork, but it's not a digging fork, because you put in the thing in the ground and it bends.
Yeah,
that's not a garden fork. But the design that I made my hoe was based on one that I think it's known as a Peterson hoe, and there's a guy called Michael Drinkwater, and he's got a website, Hand Forged Tools or something like that, and he's got a forge and a power hammer, and he makes these tools, and they're really good. They're made out of leaf spring.
I think I got a bill hook from him.
Oh, yes. Yep, that's right. He does make bill hooks. But he makes these hoes, and it's sort of like a mattock, but it's not. It fits. It's sort of a socket is forged, and the handles fits into that. And it's the closest thing that I know of is known as, is a like a tool that they use in Africa called a budza. I think that's the Shona word for it in Zimbabwe. I'm not exactly sure, but they call it a budza over there. It's either Zimbabwe or South Africa somewhere, but it's a very light mattock-like tool, but it's way lighter than a mattock, and it's thinner metal, you sharpen them up and they just slice through the soil, or you can just shave weeds off with it, and it's very light and easy to use. You just have to have the pitch of the blade set right for your height and for the type of handle that you use, so that when you hit the ground, it doesn't pull away, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
If it's at the wrong angle, yeah.
But yeah, anyway, big advice. If the listeners are thinking of going down this path of like abandoning mulching everything to death, getting good quality tools that match your body, and then taking the time to learn to use them and maintain them, it just completely transforms your approach to growing anything, really.
Yeah. Otherwise, if you've got bad tools, it's a chore.
Oh, it's torture.
It's a hard
it's
chore.
Torture. It's
yeah,
actually
it is.
Torture.
It's torture. It is. Yeah.
You mentioned
I do use a stirrup hoe too.
Yeah, if you get the timing right with them, they can be really useful. What about pests? You mentioned briefly that you do have some pests.
Yeah, well, I do occasionally. We do get fruit fly sometimes. Some years the fruit fly comes down. In northern Victoria, where we were living for about 10 years after I moved from northern New South Wales, we started to see fruit fly appear, and then it became officially regarded as endemic there, you know, as naturalized on along the Murray Valley. So that was a real shame, you know. I used to really love being able to go and pick a peach off the tree at the perfect hour of ripeness and not have to worry about looking what I'm biting into. Yeah, but that's
apologies from a Queenslander that our little homegrown insect made its way all down there.
Yeah, it's probably not your fault. There'd be a number of things, you know, probably the lax quarantine. You know, they do have quarantine sort of areas where you can put the stuff in the bin, but it's an honesty system, and if people don't see the importance of it, they don't do it.
Are they overwintering in greenhouses? Like, surely it's cold enough down there to kill any that don't have protection.
Well, in around Swan Hill and Mildura, they don't get really hard frosts there. Like a hard frost for them is maybe -2.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
we get that cold up here in Queensland. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So it's similar. You know, and the fruit fly wouldn't be too bothered by that if they're resting under some mulch or something. They've got a bit of protection because they usually go down to the soil to pupate.
Yeah.
You know, underneath leaf litter and things. So, you know, they survive up there pretty well. Whereas here, they sort of blow in from Bendigo, where it's a little bit lower elevation in Bendigo. It's a bit warmer there during the winter than it is here in Castlemaine. And so we're almost where the land goes up to the dividing range. So we're sort of at the foothills of the dividing range, I guess. You know, we're at about 250 meters elevation here, and then 20 minutes drive south of here, where, you know, you can be at 600, and there's a marked difference in the climate. You know, about 3/4 of the way up the hill, you can feel it, and then you head to Trentham, and it's about 700 something meters, and it's different again. The climate gets really wet. You know, the precipitation exceeds the evaporation. And there's a line somewhere between Dalesford and Trentham, and it's quite a different climate there, but it gets really cold.
Have you had to start doing anything for the fruit fly, or like are you breeding your way around it for a susceptible species?
No, it's not a big problem every year. Sometimes you'll get it occasionally in stone fruits. I haven't had it in chilies and peppers. And, you know, capsicums. I really like those. And we don't get them in tomatoes much. But look, there could be a long summer one year, and we might get some, you know. So until that happens.
I suspect the fruit fly tend to target the fruits that they pupate, like they were larvae in, that there's a kind of inherited taste. So if you don't, if the ones blowing in are coming from like peach orchards, then they're mostly going to be looking for those kind of fruits. And I think it takes time for them to jump between different host plants.
Yeah, okay.
That, so you might
would
be
make
lucky.
Sense, because I know that...
You might be lucky there for longer than you think.
Yeah. I know that some butterflies, once they've hatched out onto a particular host, even though a given species might feed on several different species from unrelated genera of plants, once they've started on one, it's hard to transfer them to another.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of develop a liking for a particular species. That so that is plausible, that with the fruit fly, you know, going for the ones that they like or that they know of.
So the next
yeah,
big
so
question.
We,
oh yeah, sorry, sorry, you
yeah.
go.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, luckily we don't have a lot of it here, but it's something that I'm just aware of occasionally that we may get some. Yeah, earwigs, slaters, you know, the usual things. But they're usually, those sort of pests are usually with mulch. And because I don't mulch, I don't seem to have much trouble with them.
So the next
Yeah,
big
so
question,
earwigs,
the next big
yeah.
question, what are your priorities in crop breeding?
Mainly, well, say, for example, the Central Victorian Landrace Breeding Project, with that, the main objective is to get a population of a given plant that will be able to survive in the conditions in Central Victoria on some of the dodgiest soils. Even though we've got, you know, we're spoilt for good soil here, there are other growers who will have different selection pressures with, you know, soil fertility or moisture stress or those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
So as a collective, I think it's sort of to the objective is to get things that are going to work in this climate and particularly for short season, because we can have frosts in November, even in December some years. We have quite a short season. So some of my efforts will be put into getting shorter season things and selecting for the ones that fruit earlier. Yeah, that's probably the main thing.
Yeah. Well, that's probably a good chance to jump into talking about your specific crop breeding projects. So which one do you want to tell us about to begin?
Well, I've got a bit of a thing for maize. I do like corn. I like, you know, I've had a bit of a thing for Mexican food for a while, and I do like the taste of fresh made corn tortillas. I
I'm
don't
gonna have
do
to
it
get
as
your
much
advice.
as I'd like.
I'm gonna have to get your advice on how to make
Yeah,
them at home now that I've got
okay.
buckets of dry maize sitting behind me waiting to figure out
Great.
what to do with them.
Yeah, it's look, I was sort of intimidated at first with making them because I'd read that it's involved and it's difficult, but you know, you give it a go and you work out what works and it's not too difficult.
I'll get there.
Yeah,
Every
so
year, I'll do a little bit more of the technique and get better at it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so when I was in Mildura back in the late 80s, there were a couple of friends, or one in particular, who he was really interested in chilies, and he was importing chili seeds from over in the States from different seed companies.
When it was
Days
still
when you could
relatively
just,
easy to do here, it's gotten progressively more difficult.
And you could just you write a letter and you get, you know, Redwood City Seed Company or Peace Seeds or Seeds of Change or JL Hudson Seeds to send you a catalogue. They'd send it and then you'd fill out what, you know, whatever you wanted, and you do a money order and then you send it off and then your seeds would turn up in the mail. Easy. And there were no, you know, the restrictions were way, way less back then. So we got, you know, tapari beans and chilies and a heap of other unusual edible plants, seeds from, you know, from the Americas. And back then we could buy, you know, from seed companies in Australia, from heirloom seed companies, you had a choice of maybe 10 different varieties of maize. And so I grew Hickory King back then. I liked that one because it's a nice big, big kernel. And I was intending on using it for tortillas and tamales and stuff back then, but I really didn't get into it. I moved to Northern New South Wales. 15 years later, I come back and I try to find corn seed because I wanted to grow it down here. And it was almost non-existent. Maybe there was one variety. I think it was Red Indian or something they call it.
Yeah.
Some generic maize seed. And then I found a video of this guy called Paul Ubrine over at near Bega. And it was a video of this guy showing all these different varieties of maize that he'd been growing for years and years. And it was put up by Bega Valley Seed Savers. And I thought, oh, I've got to meet this guy. He's, you know, because he showed Hickory King and Silver Mine and
that must be where I
what was
got
it?
my silver.
Golden,
I grew
Golden
silver
Superb.
mine once, and I really liked it. So I must have got it
Yep.
via them
It
somehow.
was probably via Liz Worth or somebody from Bega Seed Savers, and originally from Paul Ubrine, because he had this big container in his shed, and it was full of all these different cobs of different varieties of corn. And he was telling me, because I went over to see him. We went to Naruma for a holiday one day, and I said, I'm going to go to Bega and meet this guy. And so he gave me all these varieties of corn.
Wow.
A lot of my, he said, oh, this one, we used to grow this one for cornflakes. You know, the Kellogg's cornflakes, they'd buy this one and make cornflakes out of it. And I thought, man, this guy's got so much knowledge. I don't know, he's probably passed away by now, but it was such an insight into the varieties of corn that were available in Australia back in the past. So anyway, I persisted mainly with Hickory King because I liked the shape of that corn kernel. It was a big flat sort of, it's a good hominy corn, and it's a good, he said it was a good hill corn, like for drier country. That's what they said in the States where they grow it, was sort of more of a dry country corn, I think. But then since I got those, and I stuck with mainly with Hickory King, and I've since also got Oaxacan Green. And I've got a few other varieties, and since meeting Greg Muller and learning about the landrace gardening, I figure all I'm going to put together a population of maybe half a dozen different varieties of dent corn, because it's I like the dent corns. And so that's what I'll be putting in this year. So I've got some red ones, I've got some yellow ones, reds, yellow dent, red. There's one red variety, there's the Oaxaca Green. Yeah, anyway, there's a handful of different varieties I'll put together.
You're welcome to grab some
And
of my parrot resistant strain. It's a white maize, but with a pinkish
yep.
apricot tinge to the grains.
Okay. Nice. Yeah, I might have to try some of that then. Put some of that in the mix. Yeah, so the thing is with corn, I think it's easier to select, because I think it's the pollen parent that just determines the kernel color. So it's like a digital output of the genetics. So, you can pull out all the red ones and then sow them the following year. You've got predominantly red corn. So it's sort of fun to play with corn with all the different colors. So if I wanted to go back to a white corn or a yellow corn, I could separate those out and grow those. But I'll go for some multicolor at the moment for this year, and then see how it goes. Some of the Hickory King was getting a bit short in the kernels. Oh, it was a bit short in the cobs, and it felt like it was sort of there's a bit of genetic depression going on there. Even though I kept, I'd keep at least 100 plants in a plot. I think there's time for inject a bit of vigor into it with some other varieties, mix it up a bit. There's also Teosinte as well. I have some seeds of that, and I've grown that in the past alongside the maize when I was at Swan Hill. I had Hickory King growing up about 3 meters tall, but I also had Teosinte with that, and it was a perennial one. So I've heard it said that the Teosinte, being one of the ancestor plants of corn, can transfer genes between the Teosinte and the corn, and they say that some traditional growers of maize, they say that the Teosinte makes the corn stronger. So there may be gene flow from there from the wild genes to put a bit more vigor back into the subsequent crops.
And did you tell me that you did some hybridization between Teosinte and maize? And I'm just curious as well. Sorry for throwing
Yeah.
two questions at you at
Yeah.
once.
Go on. Yeah.
What
Yep.
was your experience growing Teosinte versus corn? Is it as vigorous as people say? Is it that different?
No, well, it was at Swan Hill where I grew that. It'd struggle in the cold, and it'd just sort of go to sleep, and then it'd come back in the spring. But I didn't actually deliberately do any crosses, but I did keep some seed from it. Yeah, but I didn't actually do any deliberate cross pollination. I'd like to, but I think it might be just a bit cold here for the Tiercinti. So maybe I should give that to you and for you to have a play with it.
I'd be willing to give it a go because yeah, I think the maize genetics that I have is reasonably good for here, but it could do with a bit of deep diversity to see if I can make it really shine.
Yeah.
And who knows, the parrots might break their beak if they try and eat it.
Yeah, well, they're pretty hard. I mean, it must have been an amazing event that you know, back about, what was it, 9,000 years ago or something, when there was a mutation in the corn and it grew a naked seed, basically, you know, without that really hard shell on it. Because the Tiercinti seeds, you put in your mouth, you break your teeth on them.
I recently saw a paper, and I think this deserves more attention. So I think it said maize was originally domesticated in like a small area, like 5,000 years ago, and it just kind of hung around there. Mm-hmm. But there was another hybridization event that happened 2,000 years ago with another species of the wild genus, and that created the population that spread out everywhere. So it goes to show the power of hybridization, that you can take it probably would have been like wheat, that it was a three-way cross. And the first cross between wild species gave you something. I think teff was the first cross leading to wheat. I could be wrong, but it was something that was usable, but it wasn't nearly as good as the next hybridization that produced the wheat that we know today.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Yeah. That would have been, I forget the names of them.
Yeah, the wild species, you don't see the names used very often.
Yeah, up in the Fertile Crescent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of those wild grasses, I think some of those are extinct now from their natural range. Yeah, it's interesting reading some of the stuff about Nikolai Vavilov when he went to these basically genetic hotspots for domesticated crops. Back in the 1920s, even going to Ethiopia, he made a couple of trips to there, and he noticed even in his lifetime there was erosion of the varieties available, like some varieties had just become extinct, and in the Caucasus, he said that there was even apples, you know, the wild apple forest in Kazakhstan were being eroded by, you know, land clearing and so there's lots that's been lost.
The big threat today is all of the diversity that managed to make its way into seed banks, and it's just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually don't have the resources to, I mean, they're doing their very best. They're doing a heroic job of like pulling things out, refreshing the seed every however many years or decades. Yeah. But those institutions are fragile and centralized, and how long they'll be able to keep going is questionable. And that the sooner that genetics can end up in the little pockets of the landscape, you know, in the hands of people who are invested in keeping it growing, the better. Yeah. That's how I see it.
Yeah, the best security for that is in the hands of people who are going to use it every day.
Mm.
And that their, you know, their lives depend on it, and that's how they keep those things going, because they use it and they're growing it all the time. Then they understand it,
and not even necessarily as the pure named varieties, because you can't stop living things from changing. Even if you try and preserve that's them in some historical state, they're going to drift and transform in ways that you, well. The only alternative is to keep them in liquid nitrogen forever, and then they may as well be extinct. Yeah.
They may as well be, yeah. It's like you know, people talk about how such a sourdough culture originated in San Francisco. The moment it's taken from one area, taken to another, in the hands of another baker, it changes.
Mm-hmm.
It changes just like that. You know, it's and that's a sort of a fast-tracked example of that change in different conditions. It's gonna express different genetic traits.
Mm.
So they really have to be grown out year after year to preserve them, really.
Now, you could maybe tell us a bit more about the work you're doing with. So you were involved in the Moss Charter pumpkin breeding project with the Central Victorian Breeding Group. So do you want to tell us a bit more about how that group worked for that particular project? That could be really interesting because I love taking time to talk about how community building and encouraging other people to get into crop breeding is working around the world. And this little project is, I think it's probably the first of its kind in Australia.
Yeah, well, I don't know a lot about the backstory of that one. I think Greg had already done a couple of generations of that, and he, as I understand, he got, butternut pumpkins from, and other Moscata varieties from different sources, and I think he put it out into the community not last year, year before last, and I grew some out here. Just poke the seed straight in the ground. I don't try to get things in early. Usually, the usual thing here is, plant after Melbourne Cup Day, so in the second week in November, but I'll leave it even till the fourth week in November or even in December. As long as the ground is warm, I'll put the seeds into that, and they can be up in a few days. And I don't think there's any advantage in me putting them in early into cold ground.
They creep
That's the other
along.
reason I don't mulch. Yeah, that's the other reason I don't mulch, is to get the heat into the ground. So yeah, I got some seeds of that, and I grew them out. There was quite a bit of diversity in those, and we ate quite a few of those, and then I had them stored, and a lot of them rotted because I didn't look after them, to tell you the truth. But I got some seed out of those. But I didn't grow them last year. I grew them the year before that, the first year. So I haven't kept up with that, but I want to get back onto that and grow them with the corn and with a mix of beans that I have to
So
get a population of each of those to, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Did the breeding project, the group breeding project, have a mechanism for sending back in the seeds of the best pumpkins?
Yeah, I think they were just going to send back the majority of them, because being the second year, like generally, we look at doing up to year three, saving everything, and then just taking a random sample, and then start selecting after the third year
That makes
for your
sense.
particular traits, the shape that you want, or the intensity of color, the levels of carotenes in it, or the hardness of the shell. And the storability,
Storability is a big one for a home grower.
and resistance to downy mildew and things like that. Yeah, I to be honest, I wasn't really on the ball with that one, but I do want to re-engage with that one again. I think they were taking, because we've got a library in town that has the seed library attached to that, and the Central Victorian Landrace Gardening Project, breeding project, is tapped into the seed library, and so that's one of the way they disseminate seeds there. But usually it's on a Facebook post, a call out, so that who wants to be in this particular breeding project, and then they'll be dropped to a central point or a person or something, and then they'll distribute them directly to the growers. Some of those, I think, will find their way back into the seed library, but it's a good little hub there for that exchange. They meet there on Thursdays, I think, once a month or something, and package up seeds, and they've got a little stand inside the library.
Hopefully, I'll have a chance
And
to
there's
talk to Greg about the project next year.
That'd be good, because he's more onto that part of it than I am, a bit more in touch with it. So
Now, did you want to tell me a bit about the YQ wheat project that you've had some involvement with? That sounds really interesting.
Well, there's a guy in the UK. He passed away a few years ago. His name is Martin Wolf, and he worked for quite a while in some government institution, I believe, researching, as a plant pathologist, researching particularly fungal diseases in grains, mainly wheat, and I think barley. And he was sort of in the mainstream, I think, and but noticed that populations of actually in East Germany, I think that he said something about in East Germany before the wall came down, they were growing. They didn't have access to the agrochemicals that you know, and pesticides and fungicides that most countries had back then, and so they grow different varieties of wheat all in the one field. So if one variety would succumb to a rust in a particular year, the other varieties would just take up the, you know, fill the space, and they'd get a yield. So they wouldn't have to resort to the, you know, spraying. So when he retired from that job, he had a place in somewhere in England. I've got friends who visited that place and visited him when he was still alive. He put together a population of, I think it was 22 different varieties of wheat that was selected for yield and or selected for quality, you know, for the milling quality and the flavor and the nutritional profiles, and put those together as a mass cross-pollination, more than just a land race variety. It's even wider than that. So massive diversity, and
I
that's
guess
what
with
was known as YQ pop.
small-seeded
What's
crops
that?
like that, it's small-seeded crops that are handled in large numbers like that, you've got much more capacity to maintain most of that diversity for through the first generations.
For sure. So, you know, you've got thousands and thousands of plants and millions of genetic crosses going on in any field of that wheat. So anyway, I'd first heard about that at the Grains Festival that was held in Trentham in, I think it was 2019 or 2018. And John Reed, a friend of mine who's since passed away, he was one of the founders of Red Beard Bakery at Trentham in Victoria, and he put together the Grains Festival. And at that festival, there were people from all around the world. There were millers, there were bakers, there were farmers. So it's sort of a vertical integration of all of these different people in the production of bread, essentially. So, and that was the things that was missing for me on the farm. You know, there was this disconnect between what my dad was doing, you know, to all hours of the night, you know, at harvesting grain. And, you know, I'd see, you know, big semi-trailer loads of grain going off. And then there was no connection between that and that fluffy cake that we call bread wrapped in plastic on the table, you know, spread with margarine. You know, it was just, there was no connection between the two. So what John Reed is, he, you know, the last sort of decade and a half or so of his life was to set about bringing those things together. And it was sort of culminated in, you know, with Red Beard Bakery, but it was also culminated in the Grains Festival. And so it was there that I was given some different varieties of wheat, some that were accessed from the seed bank that John had accessed from the seed bank over in Horsham. And also through some contacts was given some of this YQ grain. So I've grown that, and the diversity in it. There's some with really short awns, there's some with really long awns. And I sowed the first year I sowed it was into a patch that came up was full of weeds, but I still got enough grain to, you know, increase the grain that I had. So I just want to keep that one growing. I've given some to some other friends who are growing that this year. I haven't put a crop in this year, but I'll be putting some more in next year. So we just want to keep that one going.
It's an extraordinary resource because the concentration and energy in putting a grex together, even just an ordinary grex of like three or four different varieties, it takes like a special amount of focus to do that. And it's not the kind of thing you want to do every year. But when someone else has done it for you and you can access the material when it's still in that kind of undecided state about exactly what little valley in the world it would most wants to grow in. Yeah, it's such an amazing opportunity to jump into that.
Yeah, well, that population is being used, it's being grown and milled and turned into bread in the UK.
Mm.
So the you know it's
has and
it's,
that started in Australia as well.
No, that's no in the UK that one.
Okay,
but
they're ahead of us there.
There's there, yeah. We're still building a bit of seed there.
Mm.
So with that one,
well, it's still a very exciting foundation.
It is,
Are you doing any breeding with the Tipari bean? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, look, I mentioned before that a friend of mine in Mildura back in the 80s, when we were buying things from the States, he got a bunch of Tipari beans and, like about six or eight varieties of them. And
now, there's probably listeners who've never heard of this particular bean before. Can you tell us just a quick outline about what it is?
Okay.
I've managed to grow them, and I'm guessing I got the seeds on the grapevine originally from someone like you. Afraid you were.
So, it's Sacciolus acutifolius. It's a bean that grows. It's a fairly fast maturing bean, and it's suited to, you know, really well suited to dry climates. So it's from the sort of, I think, northwestern Mexico and southwest the United States, you know, Arizona, Colorado. They've been traditionally grown there for centuries. And it's very efficient with its use of water. And when it's, you know, they say it can grow on one good rainfall, you can get a crop off it. They'll bend they'll tilt their leaves so that the edge of the leaf blade is at the sun, you know, so they get, you know, minimize the sun exposure to reduce water loss. But they grow really quite quickly. And they're a small bean. They're used as a dry bean. And they only take half the energy to cook them that they would for a normal vulgaris bean. They're a thin little bean. They're actually grown in India. I've noticed I bought some Indian, you know, sort of bean snacks, you know, those little, like the bhujia mix and all that. There are some snacks that I bought from an Indian shop, and it said it was made from Tipari beans. So they obviously got onto them over there. They left their pulses over there in India. And they're grown throughout Mexico, as far as I know. I think I read somewhere that they were grown in Costa Rica as well. So I've got about eight different varieties.
They did quite well for me in the subtropics. The main issue, like no mold, no fungus issues for me. But the main problem was just keeping the weeds off them, because they're compared to something like a lima bean that can grow like 5 meters long and like get up and over and canopy out, the Tipari beans are not expecting that kind of competition.
Because they're pretty much a desert plant, you know. They grow where there's not a lot of other things, rampant growth to compete with them. So I've got about eight varieties, I think it is. You know, there's a couple of black ones, a yellow one, some brown ones, yellow ones. And in the past, I've kept them separated, you know, like only separated by a few meters. There's not a huge percentage of cross-pollination with those, I don't think. But I think I'll plant them together more closely this time and just try to get them to cross-pollinate a lot more, just get a bit more of a mix. And then I can, you know, throw all the cards in the air and collect the bits that I want later on.
It's
or
such
just
a
leave it as a diverse one.
Well, it's such a relief when you go from having to juggle like all of the different names and packets and then you're just like, no, it's just one big species, and may the best prevail.
For sure. Well, there's the more likelihood of you getting something that's going to really work in your area, but still have plenty of genetics in the background from the other stuff that, you know what I mean? There's once you've made those mass crosses, there's a lot more genetics floating around in the background that can express when that's taken to a different area.
Would you ever consider doing
population.
Hand pollination if you get frustrated waiting for the right bee to turn up at the right time?
It might be worth doing it, and then, you know, getting, you know, several pods that are a known cross.
Mm.
You know, with this one, with that one, da 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 da. You know, say like there might be what, how many different 60 or so different combinations there. I could probably do that and then keep all of those and then throw them all together and, you know, keep them separate from the main lot and then plant them out as a new batch, you know, of a more diverse batch of known cross pollinations. So
Do you know
that
the
might be
lazy way that I would
worthwhile.
do it? If I was doing
What's
eight different
that?
strains, I would take pollen
Yep.
from four of the strains,
Yep.
mix it all up,
Yep.
and apply it to the other four. So at least you
Right.
know it's cross, and
Right. You
it's
understand your work.
it cuts down all the work trying to keep track of like all of those possible combinations.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you've still
That's
got,
a much
what's
better.
that? That's at least maybe, oh, the mathematics is a bit melting my brain on that.
Yeah.
Let's say it's got
Yeah,
half of the
me too.
possible combinations, but it's probably less than that now that I think about it.
Let's just say it's working smarter, not harder.
Yeah. And if you don't get the result you want in the first year, then you do a different set of four with a different set of four.
Yeah, or even growing out the progeny from that is going to mix things up again anyway.
Yeah. Often
So,
once you start the hybridization from
yeah.
these like old inbred lines, they it puts them
Yeah.
back in the mood to do it, maybe on their own in the future.
Yeah.
So we're getting
Yeah,
close
so
to the bonus
that's the
rounds.
Tipari beans.
Yep. We're getting close to the bonus rounds, unless there's any other crops you want to mention before we wrap things up.
Nothing that I can think of. Oh, I do have, yeah, I've got some arikacha here that were given to me as the last individual seedling plants that a friend raised. So I know that they're genetically different from each other and also genetically different from the arikacha that's been kicking around in the northern, you know, North Coast, New South Wales for the last, you know, in Southeast Queensland for the last 30 odd years.
The old inbred
So
clone.
sometimes they've been known to flower. Yeah, sometimes they've been known to flower, but I've never heard of seed, viable seed coming from them. At least if I've got these two clones that are separate, I want to send those to friends up in northern New South Wales where the conditions are better for them growing up there. I got a nice crop of it this year and I'll put it in again this next year, or this coming season. But I just want to get that out there for anybody who can get them to flower and then get viable seed from that. And then it just drastically increases the genetics of that in Australia because it was one variety for at least 30 years that I know of. And
We'll
never seen it, so
have the Australian arikacha famine in our future if we don't diversify the genetics.
it's a really quite a delicious vegetable. It's so tender when you cook it. It's just really yummy. And I love parsnips, and it's a bit like a parsnip, but there's something a little bit different about it. But it's really nice.
It's nice. I would love the idea of a perennial parsnip equivalent, because particularly in the subtropics,
Yeah.
keeping the seed viable until the next season, until the next
Oh,
winter, is a real pain. And if you didn't have refrigeration, it probably wouldn't be possible.
No, it just the viability drops off so quickly. Yeah, it's hardly worth buying parsnip seed in the
Yeah,
seed packets.
it's a very big gamble as to whether you get anything out of
Yeah.
them.
Yeah, for sure. And that's one of the ones that you really do have to look at the use by date on, because you're wasting your time otherwise.
Okay.
Skirret,
Oh, skirrets.
I've
That's another interesting
got a bit
one.
of skirret seed. Yep. I found one plant in my garden that I'd sort of lost track of. I planted those, did the crown divisions, planted those out, and they've flowered and seeded, and I've got a bunch of seed there. So I can send you some of that if you like. If you
I'll
want to have
give
a
it a
play.
try. I've tried
That's
vegetative divisions of skirret before, and they just melted in our summer, but often when you grow things
yeah,
from
right.
seed, it just stirs up a
Yeah.
bit of magic and you often get adaptation where you never
That's right.
expected it. So
Yeah.
I will not
Yeah.
say no
They're
to that.
really delicious. That's a really yummy vegetable, that one.
You got me very
Very
tempted.
small yields, but yummy. Yeah. And you know, the seed's cheap, you know. Send you a teaspoon of seed or something. There's probably a few
I'll
thousand
give it
seeds in it.
a good try and see what I can do with it.
Yeah.
Now, bonus round
Yeah.
questions. If you could work
Yep.
wonders with any species and like wave a magic wand, what would you create?
Oh, crikey. I don't know. In this climate?
Sky's the limit.
I don't know. I don't know.
It could be a crop that, like, if you were going to live for another 500 years, you'd start the project.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, now that's really stumped me. Rice. I'd like to have a go at rice in this climate. I know it might be pushing it a bit, but it's probably possible because it's a really adaptable species.
Oh yeah, and there's a lot of upland rice, so they grow it all the way up into the Himalayas.
Yeah. But where do I get it? Where do I get the seed? Because you don't get that in the gene bank. I think the Rice Corporation or whatever they are, they've probably got all the genetics and won't give them out. Yeah, I'd like to maybe grow some rice here and make my own paella with all from this land here. That'd be a fun thing to do. Millet. I've got some different varieties, different species of millet. It's a little bit too cold here for them and not long enough season for some of those.
Have you ever tracked down pearl millet in Australia? It's the only one I've never been able to trial here. I'm sure the birds are going to destroy it. But there you go.
I've got some seed. Yeah, I got some from the gene bank about 14 years ago. I only grew it out a few years up there. If I can find it, you can have it because it'd probably just be too cold here. In Swan Hill, the season was a little bit short for it, I think. It's better suited to a hotter, drier climate. Yeah, but I remember going out and I was sort of one afternoon, I was looking at it and saying, oh, I think I might harvest that tomorrow and come in the next day and the sparrows have got the lot. I got a few seeds back of it, but yeah, I had about four varieties of that, and some grew only about a meter tall and some grew about 3 meters tall. So that would have been good to just sort of mix it all up. There's also finger millet I've got, Echinochloa, I think it is. Yeah, it grows these funny little, sort of like a half-clenched fist.
Yeah, like a little dragon's claw.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, I've tried all the other millets and they've all failed spectacularly, so I just have to convince myself.
Oh, really? Okay.
But given how uncommon that species is, I will make an effort to protect enough of it to put it back in the stores and give it to other people who will be in different places and might have a chance.
Okay, well, if I can find it, if I can find the seed for it in my big seed stash there,
I know the problem.
Stick it in the mail and you can have it.
Next big question. What is your vision for the future of food in your community?
I haven't thought that far ahead. So the future of food?
What about your plans to pass on your work to other growers and future generations? How do you hope to do that or are already doing that? I mean, we're talking here about sharing seeds. This is how it's done.
Yeah. Well, I hope that people would be interested enough to take it on and just keep it going. I think, you know, and what we said right at the start about the gaining, the awareness of the importance of localized food. I think that's, you know, as that builds, there'll be people who wanted to, you know, who'll want to go into farming on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's the only way they can do it is on a small scale, you know, whether it be, you know, small veggie box system or whatever it is, community supported agriculture or, but I think it's probably important for those ones to look at producing their own varieties, rather than relying on varieties that, you know, commercial varieties that might be, they might be bred in, I don't know, Italy or somewhere like that, that, you know, might not be available, you know, forever. There might come a time when they need to produce their own seed.
And finding ways of doing that in small networks makes it so much easier as well. Like doing it on your own.
Yeah, that's right.
Is a bit of a slog.
Yeah.
Like every crop is an uphill battle, but if you can spread that work between multiple different farms, you get a better result in the end too.
Yeah, and that's seed saving. It's a whole other skill apart from growing the stuff, you know, growing the produce, saving the seed and growing for seed is another skill again. But it's, you know, sometimes it depends on the soil that they're growing on, you know. You might need to grow your own so that they suit those particular conditions.
If you're starting with a diverse land race, you you've got a much better chance of something coming through that has a
totally
has a taste for your soil.
Yeah. That story about, you know, Joseph Lofthouse's melons. It's such an inspiration, that one, you know.
Absolutely. Do you have a final message for people who are thinking about getting into crop breeding and they just need a little nudge?
Take a chance, have a play with it. You know, it can be fun. You never know what you're going to get. And that's part of the fun of it. You know, you might get little surprises that you never thought possible. And particularly with the land race breeding, it's you know, old timers from in a particular area, they might say, oh, that can't be grown, or you know, like in the case of Joseph's melons, no, you can't grow them here. Mm-hmm. He ignored that and he went and did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I did with the people who said that you can't grow porcini mushrooms. Mm-hmm. I ignored them and I went out and inoculated trees in 2016, and 5 years later they came up under an oak tree.
Yep.
So you just you have a bit of faith in nature, and you do what you can to make things, as you know, to match things up as much as you can, and you get the hell out of the way and let nature do her magic, you know, and you get nice little surprises.
Wonderful. So a final end plug opportunity. If anyone wants to read more about your work or maybe get in touch with you, are there preferred channels or places people can learn more?
No, I don't publish any of what I do, or I don't sort of, I don't know, most of the stuff I do is just sort of word of mouth and network.
There's a lot of breeders out there in a similar position to you. And I would maybe encourage you to join the Going to Seed discourse group. It's a forum. I think it's a few hundred people from all around the world who are breeding all sorts of crops in all sorts of ways. And I would highly recommend
that. Sounds great.
Getting involved in that, and you might find some really useful contacts or some little hint, a trick of how you can approach things that you've never heard before.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Wonderful.
Always up for new things.
Okay, well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
No worries. Thank you.
And
thank you for the opportunity.
And maybe we'll check back in the future and see how you go.
Yeah, that'd be great.